Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. The State Attorney General's Office says an event in Claremont 2 years ago, initially described as an attempted lynching, was not motivated by racial animus. Governor Chris Sununu signs a bill aimed at supporting the state's struggling dairy industry. And Dartmouth College and plaintiffs in a Title IX class action lawsuit have agreed on a settlement. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we'll talk about them in this hour. If you've got questions about the week's news, send them by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. Just search for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And that's also where you can watch a live video of this radio broadcast. Again, search for us on Facebook, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Kevin Landrigan, State House reporter at the New Hampshire Union Leader, Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Thank you very much, everybody, for being here.
Good morning, Peter.
Hi, Peter.
So let's start by talking about the biggest story nationally this week and implications locally. Mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio over the weekend prompted calls from New Hampshire's delegation to take up gun legislation passed by the House earlier this year. Kevin Landrigan, what can you tell us about this legislation?
Yeah, certainly they want to close the so-called gun show loophole, which allows guns in some, not in all states, but in many states to be purchased without doing a background check. Some will recall, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, there actually was kind of almost critical mass for this legislation. At that time, it was called the Toomey Manchin Bill. It had bipartisan support in the Senate. Folks will remember there was a Republican alternative that Kelly Ayotte, the New Hampshire senator at the time, supported. All the congressional delegation now is Democratic. They all support closing this loophole, but Mitch McConnell has kept this bottled up in the Senate, has given no indication he's even going to allow it to be voted on, despite President Trump's repeated support for background checks in the wake of these shootings. The president did not outline specifically what he wants to see, and the reason he doesn't do that is because he doesn't have Republican congressional support due to the gun lobby.
Dean?
Yeah, you know, this is a familiar loop that we're stuck in once again of a mass casualty event and Democrats calling for significant gun control reforms and Republicans talking about it a little bit, perhaps, but yet in the end, typically not much comes of it. We did eventually see a ban of the bump stocks in the wake of the Las Vegas shooting, but that took a long time to finally come about, and that was a fairly specific item. So the question is this going to be different? You know, I heard a lot of politicians over the last few days say that this time it feels different. But I recall people saying that after every one of these mass casualty events. So we shall see. The one difference is Mitch McConnell has actually uttered the phrase background check legislation. So that's unusual. Typically, Republicans have focused mainly on mental health issues. This red flag law that you hear about would allow people to who are a potential danger to have their guns removed for some period of time. They've talked a little bit about that. It was, you know, we also have going on. So one issue is what's going to happen at the national level. We're not going to know until after the recess. McConnell's not bringing the Senate back, but there is some potential for a little bit of reform. At the state level, now we have a Governor Sununu has three possible bills that he could sign at the state level, background check loophole bill, a waiting period bill, and a gun-free school zone bill. My expectation prior to this latest event was that he would not sign any of them. He would probably veto them. Maybe that will change. I'm interested to hear what others think, but he does have that option. Interestingly enough, if you read his statement right after the shooting events that took place in El Paso and in Ohio, I believe there was nothing in the statement that mentioned guns at all. It talked about mental health, and it talked about beefing up school security. There was no mention of anything dealing with guns or high-capacity magazines or any of that. So it kind of gives you a good sense of where he is. You know, the NRA is not quite as powerful as it once was. It's having some internal turmoil that may make it less of a lockdown, certainly at the congressional level. But we've been through this loop so many times that I tend to be skeptical that anything major is going to come of this. It'll, as people often say, if it didn't happen in the wake of Sandy Hook with, 20 kids, when is it likely to happen?
Anna Brown.
Sure. So just to sort of help our listeners track these, the three bills that are currently waiting for Sununu are HB 514, which would be a three-day waiting period for delivery of a firearm, HB 564, which would ban firearms on school property, and HB 109, which would require sales and transfers of firearms to take place through licensed dealers, the background check bill. So as Dean said, I don't think it's likely that Sununu will sign these. One of the first bills he signed when he first came into office was to remove the license to carry a concealed firearm. So now you can carry concealed in New Hampshire without having to get a special license. So I don't think it's going to go through this year, but it is interesting because there are already bills that have been proposed and are waiting in committee over the summer that are going to come up again in 2020 that will bring this issue to the forefront again. So HB 687 is in committee. That's similar to the federal red flag law that Dean was talking about. So it established extreme risk protection orders, which would require someone to surrender firearms to law enforcement if a court finds they pose a significant risk of violence. So that's going to come up again next year. And the House also has considered another bill, which would just give local schools the control to decide if they want to ban firearms. Rather than a statewide ban, it would give each individual school district the choice. So even if he vetoes these bills, this debate is going to stay alive for a long time.
And the prospect of a veto from the governor, Kevin, did not deter activists from showing up at the State House this week. You covered that for the Union Leader. What did they have to say?
Yeah, it was pretty emotional, actually. A couple of hundred people jammed the legislative office building to support to kind of plead with Sununu to the mantra was basically let these become law. We know you're not going to sign them. He knows, the activists know that's not going to happen. But, Katie Henry is a 2018 graduate of Concord High School, and she said, Governor Sununu, I'm asking you directly right now to do the bare minimum to protect the students, teachers, and citizens of our state, gun-free school zones, thorough background checks, and a three-day waiting period, interrupt no one's rights, and keep everyone safe. And it was, in the main, it was kind of a respectful protest. And I think that's certainly what Democratic legislative leaders understand. This is not a time to belittle Sununu and try and gain political points. It's an attempt to massage him and try and get him to see clear to at least allowing one of these bills to become law without his signature. As my two able guests here, along with me, have said earlier, they don't expect that to happen. I don't expect that to happen. He received all three bills on Wednesday. He has until Monday night to make a decision. He said that more gun regulation really isn't the answer. We're one of the safest states in the country, and we happen to have some of the most lax gun restrictions in the country. So he doesn't see the connection between in New Hampshire, at least, between violent crime and more regulation of gun ownership.
Mm-hmm. One of the things the governor did say was that mental health is part of the issue here. So I wanted to ask you, Kevin, what do mental health experts have to say about that?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of science about mental health and guns and that some people with mental health problems can become violent, but there's really no connection. And we saw meaning that just because you're depressed doesn't mean you're likely to use a gun or to threaten someone with a gun. And to suggest that is really to stigmatize people with serious mental problems. And we saw in this debate this week. Joe Biden, for example, a Democratic frontrunner, basically came out with a very strong statement in an interview with Anderson Cooper on CNN in which he said, "This is hate. It's not about depression. It's not about mental health. It's not an illness that someone is threatening violence or actually commits violence. Let's call it for what it is. It's hate that is bred into people, sometimes by their parents, sometimes by their environment, but certainly not by some mental health problem they're having."
Dean, what do you think?
Yeah, this is a this is the fundamental debate that we're hearing, and Republicans have gone to the mental health issue as kind of their primary way of countering pressure that they're not doing enough. I heard some people talk about privacy issues with mental health, and perhaps somebody is suffering from PTSD, maybe a veteran or some first responder, and will they never be allowed to have guns? And so there are on both sides of the issue, there are these kinds of concerns. And, I even hear people say, well, by definition, if you're willing to kill 20 or 30 people in cold blood, that's a mental health issue, whether it's motivated by hate or not. Anybody who has the capacity to do that. So there's a range of arguments. Again, the thing that people should keep an eye on are these two levels. What's going to happen in the U.S. Congress, which is really going to depend on Mitch McConnell, and what's going to happen here locally, which is really going to depend on whether or not Governor Sununu vetoes or lets those local pieces of legislation go into effect without his signature.
Anna Brown.
So I think it's also worth remembering that there's a debate in New Hampshire I haven't heard about recently about whether mental health records should be reported to the National Criminal Background Check System. And so
it's a privacy issue.
It's a privacy issue. And at this point, correct me, fellow guests, but I'm pretty sure that New Hampshire is not reporting at this point. And so there's a question of, would these background checks, expanding it, would that even help? But also, if we do start reporting those mental health records, then how does someone sort of get out of this system? How do they get off that if they're ever sort of get that scarlet letter that they have a mental health issue? So that's another debate that I'm curious to see if that'll come up again.
Listeners, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Send us an email if you've got questions about the week's news or comments. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. 2 years ago, reports of an attack on a biracial boy in Claremont made national news. The narrative that dominated the conversation at the time was that the older children tried to hang the 8-year-old boy. 2 years later, nearly 2 years later, the state has completed its investigation, and now we have a 25-page report on what happened. The big takeaway from that report is that the state was not able to conclude that the attack was motivated by racial animus. Kevin, based on the state's investigation, what actually happened?
Well, the investigation said an 8-year-old boy had suffered neck injuries when he was with his older sister and several of these teenage boys. And the other two boys, they're not identified in this report other than boy one and boy two. They put rope around their necks and jumped off the picnic table, and they landed safely. And then the 8-year-old kind of mimicked the behavior. He put a rope around his neck, and one of the other boys pushed him off the table. His legs didn't reach the ground, so he started swinging from his neck and got injured. A lot of the narrative that followed after that was that the older boys had used taunting racial language against the victim earlier in the day. The state could not prove that the incident was racially motivated. They said we can't find that there was a hate crime that occurred here. This was delinquent behavior by juveniles, young kids behaving badly. But as we've seen before in the national media, in Lily White, New Hampshire, these stories become the national narrative is New Hampshire's racist and racist things happen up in New Hampshire. And that story was run with virally, internationally, with regard to this story. And some family members of this boy certainly did their level best to fan those flames in the national media. This report, I think, does a service in terms of providing context to what was just really bad behavior by these kids, but not proven to be racial. It's important to point out media outlets have tried to get the 400 pages of this investigation release, but a judge has already denied that in court.
Yeah. So the distinction here that I think is really important is that it's not that there wasn't racist language used.
Correct.
It's that the court was unable to determine that the what happened to this 8-year-old boy was the result of racial animus. It's not to say that there was not racial things said, right, Anna?
And basically the idea is the 8-year-old boy put the rope around his neck himself, and the older boy pushed him or scared him off the table, and it was when the police first arrived on the scene, the kids basically said it was an accident. So but as Kevin said, I think that the important thing here is not what exactly motivated this specific one incident, but the idea that it reflects everybody's reaction to it reflects a larger conversation that's happening in New Hampshire. And let's remember that this was incident was one motivation for the governor's advisory council on diversity and inclusion to convene. And they released a series of recommendations in December 2018. And the legislature has acted on some of those. For example, SB 263, which is going to allow people to sue schools if they are the subject of a discrimination based on age, sex, gender identity, race, and so on. So there has been some legal changes, and I think that this event, you know, regardless of the exact things that happened, it reflects this larger tension that's going on in New Hampshire.
Yeah, Kevin really zeroed in on the fascinating part of the story, which is the way in which it was interpreted by the national media, and in part because it fit a kind of a pre-existing notion of New Hampshire. We've talked on the Roundup in the past about some other racial issues in schools around the state, so you know it kind of fit that storyline. The phrase near lynching, that's a very powerful phrase to use, and you know, as soon as the national and international media saw that, they ran with it. As it turns out, the reality of the story was somewhat more complicated. But you know, there's a good lesson here. I don't know that's going to be learned. It's just the nature of social media and how fast information, you know, stuff happens as we go along, and then it has to be kind of taken back and kind of rephrased.
So what's the lesson we as news consumers should take away from this, Dean?
Well, you have to be a very careful consumer of the news. You know, for reporters and others covering this, I mean, I'm literally old enough to remember when, you know, stuff like this would take a few days for the reporting to develop over
right.
time. And now it's, you know, as soon as it happens, it's out there, and you can't pull it back once it's out on social media. I don't know that there's any easy answer to that, but it's just a reminder that sometimes you have to wait to really understand the details.
Yeah, so my father was an intelligence officer, and I actually one thing he always said is you never believe the first report,
right.
And that's actually something that I kind of live by, and I feel that this is another example of that. You know, the first thing you hear, you know, on social media is there was an attempted lynching, and that don't believe the first report.
Mm-hmm. And Kevin, you mentioned that the parents had some role in perpetuating that narrative that this was an attempted lynching. Have the parents, since this 25-page report come out, said anything publicly?
No, they have not. Not what we've seen anyway. And at the time after the incident, they called out the Claremont police chief for not doing enough to investigate this case. And he was put in a pretty difficult position at that point, as Dean and Anna have alluded to, because he can't say what he already knows, because the state is already investigating the possibility that this was a hate crime. But he's got some information that maybe it wasn't, but that he couldn't share. He took a lot of hits, and in some ways, this report shows that he was prudent in his response.
I think the other important dynamic to remember here is that it was juveniles. And so that adds a whole different color to this, because there's confidentiality issues. And let's also remember that children are not fully mature. So I think that if this was a situation with adults, we would be having a very, very different conversation.
That said, as soon as or shortly after the incident came out, the child's name was made public by someone raising money for the family on a GoFundMe campaign. I mean, the child's photo was front and center on that page. His name was there. His name was in the name of the fundraising campaign, and the campaign raised close to $55,000. One of the questions I have now is, what happens to that campaign? I guess nothing, right? You know, people who give to a GoFundMe campaign sort of have to understand the risks of the narrative not being exactly what it says it is, right? I mean,
Yeah, I mean, there have definitely been, I do not know the details of that GoFundMe campaign and where the money was going, so I cannot possibly speak to that. But I do know in general that there have been plenty of examples of GoFundMe campaigns in the past where, people don't know where the money's going.
So, Dean, I guess in addition to, you know, and Anna, not trusting the first story you read in the news, also applies to any kind of fundraising campaign you may see associated with the news story. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. When we come back, we'll be talking about the settlement between Dartmouth College and plaintiffs in the Title IX class action lawsuit. If you've got questions about that or anything else in the news this week, send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Stay close. We'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
On Monday, The Exchange continues its four-part in-depth series, Exploring Education, which is examining different subjects concerning K-12 education in New Hampshire with a look at teacher education and professional development. That's on Monday, live at 9, but right now we're taking a fresh look at the events of the past week on the New Hampshire News Roundup. In the studio with me are Kevin Landrigan, State House reporter at the New Hampshire Union Leader, Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. After more than a week of mediation, Dartmouth College and the plaintiffs in the Title IX class action lawsuit have reached a settlement. Anna, remind us first a little bit about this lawsuit. What did the plaintiffs allege here?
Sure. So there are originally seven plaintiffs and then two more joined for a total of nine. And they were suing Dartmouth over sexual harassment and assault by faculty in the neuroscience department. And this was, you know, really ran the gamut from inappropriate comments and meetings in bars or other inappropriate places to more serious assaults. So originally they were asking for $70 million, and this settlement is for $14 million, and it's also going to have Dartmouth put money towards programs and initiatives to combat sexual harassment and assault on campus.
Mm-hmm. And does Dartmouth have a firm plan for what those initiatives might be, or are those still under development?
I believe that it's still under development. And also, let's remember that this settlement does have to be approved by the court.
Okay. And Dean, how big a deal is this, do you think?
Mm-hmm. It's a pretty big deal. It's been really interesting to watch Dartmouth kind of do a very delicate balancing act here between not admitting culpability, saying that they actually did take these complaints seriously when they arose, but then on the other hand, saying that they want to work to improve the climate on campus and educate faculty, staff, and students about sexual harassment and assault. So, you know, the fact that they were able to do it through mediation rather than it ending up in the courts, I think, is something they wanted to avoid. They've had a lot of public they've taken a lot of public relations hits with this stuff in recent years. I should mention that the three faculty members that were accused of this, very prominent individuals, one retired and the other two resigned when it was clear that Dartmouth was going to revoke their tenure. So none of them are there, and they're all banned from campus permanently.
Mm-hmm. Kevin?
Yeah, the problem for Dartmouth College is this is not a one-off, right? I mean, let's talk about Animal House. Let's talk about other cases of sexual harassment that have occurred on that campus. And as Anna was pointing out, this was serial behavior that happened to these three folks. Some of the women were in positions of control of these folks. They were interns or wanted to be eventually junior staffers in that neuroscience department. So they were taken advantage of. They were, I think, sexually assaulted, certainly by my definition. And then after relationships that may have, in one case, thought to be consensual, they were preyed upon, they were stalked. And I think the college is has gotten the message. And I think they are genuinely interested in turning the page here. And this campus climate and culture initiative they're putting together is, we've been told, is going to be very robust.
Well, and if you remember, I think the 6 of the 9 named themselves in a New York Times article, and that was a very powerful picture of all the women publicly sitting together. And that really raised the stakes, I think, for Dartmouth to come up with some kind of resolution.
So the next step in this, I guess, is learning what those new plans will be and seeing how well Dartmouth College follows through on those plans. Also in the news this week, Governor Chris Sununu signed a bill into law that supporters say will help prevent suicide among young people. The bill will require schools to develop policies on suicide prevention, response, and risk assessment, and to provide suicide prevention training for faculty, staff, and volunteers. Anna Brown, can you talk a little bit about this bill? What prompted it?
Sure. So there were actually a couple similar bills proposed in the House and Senate this year, and the idea was teachers need to be trained in how to address the issue of teen suicide because it is a big problem in New Hampshire. So according to data from the Centers for Disease Control, suicide is the leading cause of death for New Hampshire residents age 15 through 19. And data from the Youth Risk Behavior Survey shows that 16% of New Hampshire high schoolers said they seriously consider suicide, and 6% have actually attempted suicide. So this is a mental health issue that is, I think, really time to have a serious conversation about this in New Hampshire. And hopefully by requiring teachers to be trained in this, also staff, volunteers that are in schools, that can help them identify students who are at risk and hopefully prevent some tragedies. One thing to note is the Department of Education estimates the cost will vary depending on what programs schools already have in place and what they need to add. And a school without any program is looking at a cost of about $25,000.
Wow. And so how do school districts tend to feel about this? Has anybody spoken out publicly about how?
Well, I think that there's always concerns about school funding. I remember earlier this year we had the bill that is requiring schools to provide tampons and pads for free in public bathrooms.
And some of the opposition was,
and some of the option was, it's going to cost. And so I think that that's just a trade-off we have to remember. With all these really important good ideas and programs, there is a cost. And, you know, for me personally, I'm just always going back to the school funding debate. And that's sort of in the background with the budget. But this is just another item where, you know, local schools have a lot they have to pay for, and we have to figure out how to pay for that as a state.
That said, supporters of this are really enthusiastic about it, and they really feel like it's going to save some lives.
Absolutely. Well, like I said, it's the leading cause of death for teenagers in New Hampshire. Gosh, what are we going to do?
Mm-hmm. Also in the news that we've been reporting on this week at NHPR, a former investigator is suing the Merrimack County attorney, alleging a hostile work environment and gender discrimination. Jennifer Adams filed the suit on Wednesday. She claims that Robin Davis, who was elected county attorney as a write-in candidate last year, abused her power and verbally attacked her. Davis declined to comment on the lawsuit. Governor Chris Sununu is asking for a federal disaster declaration after heavy rainfall caused flood damage in Grafton County in July. Sununu says state and local damages from the storm have topped $2.8 million so far, and that's really overwhelming the budgets of some small towns. Also, the New Hampshire Lottery is seeking proposals from potential online vendors and retailers to offer sports betting, which was recently legalized. Mobile betting and retail gambling at 10 locations will be allowed, though it will take some time to set it up. The lottery expects to approve final contracts by the end of November. Also in the news this week, NHPR reported that for the second year in a row, Governor Chris Sununu has vetoed a plan to subsidize New Hampshire's biomass power industry. Kevin, how would this bill have worked?
Yeah, they essentially want to require you would require utilities to charge ratepayers extra to subsidize 6 wood-fired power plants. And this is the second year in a row, as you pointed out, that he vetoed this bill. And the reason was, the legislature actually overrode that veto by one vote last year. So it should have become law, right? But it got tied up in a legal debate. Eversource convinced the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that the bill actually tried to usurp federal powers. So this bill kind of is the second bite of the apple and tries to actually create – it orders the Public Utilities Commission to set up a rate-setting situation that would lead to ordered rates by the state regulators for these biomass plants to – be built. They have bipartisan support, but Governor Sununu has been very vocal about the price of energy in New Hampshire that is not going down. that he believes continues to be one of the obstacles to a continually growing economy. So he's pushed back a great deal against these things.
Mm-hmm. He said in that essentially the government shouldn't be picking winners and losers. Right. Therefore, you know, the government should not subsidize the biomass industry in this way. Whereas opponents, Dean, right, they would say that, you know, a couple extra bucks on a utility rate per month would be worth roughly 1,000 jobs that this would involve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. This is the, you know, this is the fundamental debate over energy in New Hampshire since Governor Sununu has taken office. He made it very clear that he was going to shift the focus from trying to reach a particular balance of renewables versus traditional sources of fuel and focus instead on the cost structure and the price of energy and kind of let the chips fall where they may in terms of what sources you use. So for him, you know, rather than focusing on biomass as an alternative to traditional fossil fuel or natural gas, you know, the issue for him is the impact on cost. And this is a little bit different than last year. I think the bill last year would have required the utilities to buy power from these plants. This is a ratepayer subsidy that was attached as an amendment to a study committee bill on microgrids, microgrids. So it was a little bit more arcane, but we're basically in the same position. This fundamental debate between opponents and the governor over policies. You know, how do you, if you're going to focus on price, what are the trade-offs between price and these other issues of renewability and impact on the environment?
Worth mentioning that this time the biomass subsidy language was attached to legislation that would have set up a study committee on microgrids, local isolated energy systems. This bill could still be over. The legislature could override this veto. Anna, what do you think? Is it likely to happen?
It'll be close. It's definitely possible. When it passed the House and Senate, it was just under that 2/3. So it's probably going to be a matter of attendance, as we've seen a lot of times in these House votes in particular. It's who shows up on that day, and of that total number, what's that 2/3 number? Who's going to vote in favor? So it's right on that sliver edge.
It's also about party loyalty too, as Anna alluded during the break. Is that you know, Democrats have more seats in the legislature. They now have the majority, but the Republicans are increasingly loyal to this governor, as the NHPR veto tracker points out. You know, we're up almost to 40 vetoes, and I think a lot of these vetoes are going to be sustained not on policy, but on party politics. Stick with your governor. He made the call. We're in the minority. The way we get back to the majority in 2020 is not to undermine this governor.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, give us send us a note if you have a question or a comment about the week's news. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or check out our Facebook page where we've got a live video of this radio broadcast. Just search for NHPR Exchange on Facebook. You could also comment there if you feel the urge. Today, Friday, is the deadline for Governor Sununu to make up his mind on a bill that would raise the minimum wage in New Hampshire to $12 an hour by 2022. Kevin, you wrote about a peaceful demonstration outside the governor's office staged by supporters of the boost in wages. How did that go?
The Democratic Party had put a petition together. About 800 people signed a petition. 50 of them were Republicans and independents. So they staged this demonstration outside the governor's office with this petition on kind of a scroll, and they unwound the scroll, and it went all the way down the hallway of the governor's suite, down to the Secretary of State's office, around the corner, trying to make the point that this idea of a minimum wage has a lot of strong support in New Hampshire. It's a big priority of this new Senate Democratic president, Donna Soucy from Manchester. She has sponsored raising the minimum wage 7 times and really feels this is the opportunity to get it done. Today is the deadline. We expect this governor to veto this bill, in part because the National Federation of Independent Business opposes this bill. There are business owners that support minimum wage increases, don't get me wrong, but there are business groups that oppose it. And this has to also be layered in with this ongoing state budget battle. And by that, I mean Sununu needs the support of the business community to continue to defend his veto of the state budget over business tax increases and opposing business tax increases. So I think that's why he'll veto this bill. But there's been a vigorous attempt by supporters of the minimum wage. Since this bill was passed in June, every single day, a group called Raise Up New Hampshire with the American Friends Service Committee and a number of other human service and progressive organizations have been delivering pens to the governor's office every single day since late June, trying to encourage him to use that pen to sign this bill.
Mm-hmm. Dean, what do you think?
Yeah, there is no greater litmus test to the differences between Republicans and Democrats that I can think of. Of whether or not you support raising the minimum wage. Maybe abortion, maybe gun control, but probably not. This is just set in stone. If you're a Republican, you oppose raising a minimum wage. If you're a Democrat, this is something that's become very important to you. We've seen a number of experiments in different states and municipalities. And economists are kind of looking to see, you know, there's these competing arguments about whether it's a good thing or whether it actually forces employers to lay people off and right. or raise prices because it affects the whole pay structure going all the way up the going up the workforce. So, you know, I have no expectation that he's going to sign it. As I mentioned before, we had him on the exchange the morning after he was reelected in 2018, and Laura Kanoi asked him if he would support a minimum wage increase, and he said, "Now, why would I do that?" And that's just sort of symptomatic of this fundamental litmus test about if you're a Republican, you don't support these kinds of minimum wage bills.
Anna Brown.
Two other things I just wanted to note. So we were talking about veto overrides, and let's just note no Republicans voted in favor of SB 10. So there's no chance of a veto override if he doesn't sign this. Mm-hmm. The other thing I think that's a worthy point when it comes to the business community is when I just talk to different business people casually, you know, what do you think about this bill? A lot of them kind of felt it was unnecessary because New Hampshire has such a workforce shortage. They're having to raise their minimum wage regardless of what the state sets. So I think that that's another dynamic here. And maybe raising the minimum wage across the board would help New Hampshire get more workers, or maybe it would just have no impact because businesses kind of have to do this already.
Yeah, like to that point, the median wage for a fast food restaurant chef is $10.30 an hour. That's $3 above the federal minimum wage of $7.25 in New Hampshire. And so that's one of the other pushbacks here. To Anna's point is there's so much pressure right now to increase wages in order to fill jobs that go begging. We don't need this bill. That's the argument.
Kevin, since you mentioned the budget earlier, I want to ask you where things stand now with respect to the budget.
Well, we're sort of still in a holding pattern now, right? We took some actions last week at the Legislative Fiscal Committee because we had to allow some agencies to get more money than they were entitled to under this continuing resolution that we're operating under now without a budget for the next 3 months. So I won't say the pressure is off, but that allows the parties privately to keep negotiating. And negotiations continue. And I think there's some movement, but it's not glacial, but it's not at warp speed either. I mean, this governor, for example, signaled to the healthcare community that he was willing to work with the legislative leaders about a signature dispute in this budget, and that is Medicaid provider rates. The Democratic legislative leadership wants to raise them across the board for all Medicaid providers. And this governor said it should be done piecemeal. Some providers deserve more than this average increase that the budget would provide to everyone, but not all of them do. And one of the compromises that's circulating now is essentially to allow all providers to have an opportunity to get an increase, but to have this legislative fiscal committee arbitrate how big that increase should be depending on the job.
Mm-hmm. All right. So what's the next step for the budget? What should we be watching for?
Next week, there is a hearing where I think the topic is education, where folks will be encouraged across the state to come in and talk about the impacts of a vetoed budget on education. The education education aid is another big breaking point. This governor supports increasing aid to education, but not permanently changing the education formula, not going as high as this veto budget had done. He fears it would create this basically this ongoing future deficit once surplus revenues were no longer could be used to increase aid to education.
Yeah, the other thing that was in the budget was a committee or commission actually to study the issue of school funding. And so now that's not happening either. And so not only do we get more funding or a different funding formula, we're not even studying what to happen. It's a big holding pattern. And meanwhile, we've had that recent court ruling that says the state has to redo its formula. It's not meeting its obligation. So, you know, everybody's been really, it seems a lot of people have been focused on the business tax issue and really debate over where those rates are going to be set. But I think the real driver, the push behind, we have to get a budget through, we have to come up with a solution, is the school funding problem.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Still to come, Governor Sununu signed legislation this week that is meant to give a boost to the dairy industry in the state. We'll look at how the bill will do that. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, Kevin Landrigan, State House reporter at the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. This week, Governor Sununu signed legislation that is meant to give a boost to the struggling dairy industry. Anna Brown, how would this law do that?
Sure. So it creates a dairy premium program. Basically, milk producers in New Hampshire could choose to participate in the program or not. And if they participate, they put a special label on their milk that's, you know, made in New Hampshire or from New England. And consumers then pay a little extra for that milk with that label. And that specific extra amount goes into a fund, which is then used to assist New Hampshire dairy producers. So the idea is milk prices are pretty much set at the federal level. It's very hard sometimes for milk producers to make a living when they can't really control pricing. And so this is supposed to give a boost to people in the Granite State. And it's sort of a combination of marketing and also direct financial assistance.
Dean?
Yeah, and the issue here for people who either oppose or support this idea, obviously the idea is to help preserve dairy farming in New Hampshire and in New England. It really rests on the idea that people would be willing to pay a little bit more. I don't know exactly what the surcharge would be on the milk, but be willing to pay a little bit more in exchange for helping preserve these farms. And that's the economic question at the heart of this, is whether or not it'll actually work as intended. You know, how much would it actually produce for this fund?
Yeah, the Concord Monitor had an alternate view of the optimism that the governor displayed about this bill. They talked to the president of the Northeast Dairy Foods Association, which represents dairy distributors, Bruce Krupke. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. He said that the organization was opposed to the bill in part because they thought it might depress sales over the long term.
Right. The idea is, will people pay for New Hampshire milk with a special New Hampshire label? Or will they just say, why is that more expensive, and just buy milk elsewhere? The thing to remember is this is a voluntary program. Dairy producers in New Hampshire don't have to participate. So I think it's pretty much going to be an experiment to see, is this working as marketing and to generate more revenue, or is it just driving sales away?
Yeah, the Dairy Premium Fund will cost an estimated about 50 cents more, I guess, per unit. And it calls to mind sort of the kind of defense that the state of Vermont puts up when you say it's a Vermont-made product, and people seem to like that, although I don't know if there's an actual corresponding program where there's a fund for anybody making Vermont products in the same way that this would make a fund for New Hampshire dairy farmers making dairy products in New Hampshire. I'm not sure if that's corresponding, but it seems like it's another state effort to defend its brand in a way and also
yes.
protect its industry.
It's interesting because it's sort of the inverse of some other bills we've seen over the years that would let local food businesses and farms put a New Hampshire label product on it and then be exempt from some other federal food regulations. So this sort of goes in the opposite direction as a way to help business owners in New Hampshire that are creating New Hampshire products.
So it seems like it would be necessary for the state to also have some kind of consumer education component. In other words, advertising to say, hey, that's what this label means. Is that part of this?
Yes, it is. And that's an important component of it, because the idea is if people don't know what that label means and why they would want to pay 50 cents more, then the program will fill. And, but the, also the idea is just having the label out there, whether people exactly know or not, it says made in New Hampshire. You know, people have state pride. You know, it's going to perhaps raise some awareness about the dairy industry in New Hampshire.
So we got a question by email from Fred in Canterbury, who says, it's okay to pick winners and losers for dairy farmers, but not biomass or solar. I think Fred is referring to the fact that the governor said, you know, we're not going to pick winners and losers with respect to the biomass plant, which is why he decided to veto the bill for biomass subsidies. But he willingly signed this over. I guess Fred's arguing that this is kind of picking a winner, the dairy industry. Dean, what do you make of Fred's comment?
That's an interesting comment. You know, we'll see whether or not, in fact, this particular program even works. Again, Anna, your point about, you know, pride in the state, absolutely. But you could, since it's voluntary, you could foresee one milk producer not doing it, another doing it, and seeing how that affects the sales of the relative products. And, you know, I think this is something economists are going to look into. But sure, I mean, this is the kind of criticism that I've heard before in this sort of situation.
Yeah. So if I had to put on my Governor Sununu hat, I would guess that his statement would be that this is a voluntary program. No one has to put the label on the milk. No one has to buy the milk.
To pay it, right?
Whereas the biomass subsidy would be all ratepayers in New Hampshire.
I see. Okay. Well, let's get an update on the 2020 presidential primary because we're going to get some visits in the coming week from candidates. Polling, Kevin, you've been writing about, rather Paul Steinhardt has been writing about, you've been writing about other things related to the primary, but polling shows that Vice President Joe Biden's still on top, Senators Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, within a few percentage points of each other, and then a variety of candidates pretty close to each other as well down below. In your view, Kevin, how's the race shaping up?
Yeah, well, I think the race is still coming together. There are a lot of people who want to, and I guess it's because of my 10th primary. I've seen this movie before. A lot of people want to declare the race over too early. A lot of people want to declare the front runner is going to win much too early. Let's look at the numbers of that Suffolk University Boston Globe poll. The number of people surveyed who picked Joe Biden was slightly larger than the number who said undecided, even though they were given two dozen choices on which to pick. So that's why this race, even in this survey, 58% said they're likely to change their minds between now and the first in the nation primary. But Biden sort of righted the ship at that second debate. He performed better than expected. The expectations were lowered for him. He seems to have steadied himself. But we are seeing certainly some building support for Elizabeth Warren. She did very well in this poll, right behind Bernie Sanders, which certainly was encouraging for her. And I think she has some momentum. But so did Herman Cain. So did Chris Christie. So I don't get overly excited by this, the August momentum. It often doesn't lead to much at all when it matters.
Yeah, we're about 6 months out, Dean.
Right, that's right. And I'll have to defer to Kevin. This is only my seventh, so you've got me beaten by a couple.
Because I'm old.
We're both getting up there in numbers. I think Kevin's right. The interesting story from the recent polling data, you have this Iowa caucus Democratic poll from Monmouth that just came out the other day. And, you know, the big story for me is we're still dealing with the same group of roughly five candidates, Biden, Warren, Harris, Sanders, and Buttigieg. The interesting story, Warren in that Monmouth poll is up 12 since April. So she's up now at 19%. That's a 12-point increase for her. Sanders has dropped significantly. He's down at 9%. Biden is still around 28%, I think he was in this poll, high 20s. In some polls, he's in his low 30s. That's Iowa. New Hampshire may be a little bit different. I think Sanders' support is a little stronger in New Hampshire. There's been some conflicting polling here. But I think increasingly people feel like we're headed for some kind of, at least for now, a Biden-Warren kind of showdown, at least in kind of the fall debates, perhaps.
Not a Biden-Sanders showdown?
Well, I mean, that was the thinking for a long time, but I think increasingly, given the kind of momentum that Warren has, I think that's what people are interested in seeing. You know, it could be Sanders as well, but he's had a little difficulty in recent weeks in terms of the polling.
Anna Brown.
So kind of jumping off what Kevin was saying earlier, when you're looking into the polling data and breaking down, you know, all right, how decided are you basically as voters? That was one thing that stuck out to me is the people who are looking at Biden, Sanders and Warren. They're the three front runners. And also a lot of those people are saying, oh, yeah, I've made up my mind. I'm not going to change my mind. So I think that's interesting to tease out because it's, you know, if those people are sort of sticking to their guns, then there's a lot less wiggle room for those candidates to play with for those undecided voters. You know, that's, you know, half people have already made up their mind. And when you have a field of dozens of candidates, it doesn't take a huge percentage of the vote to win. You know, you could get 15%, and if everybody else is lower than 15%, then you've won the primary. The other thing I just wanted to throw out there, just because I think it's worth remembering, is so we're talking about sort of six candidates that are in the top: Biden, Sanders, Warren, Harris, Buttigieg, and Gabbard. Three of them are women. I just think that's pretty cool. That's a dramatic change from any other presidential primary, really.
Yeah, and what's really interesting about this cycle and why these polls matter about this cycle is now they're a big bar. Now the next round of debates, you have to have, and Democratic National Committee says you have to have more financial supporters. You have to have higher support in these benchmark polls. This poll by the Boston Globe and Suffolk University isn't a benchmark poll, but you saw kind of, for example, there are nine people now who've qualified for this next round of debate. You saw frantic emails from Kirsten Gillibrand's campaign, the New York senator. She's not reached that level in those benchmark polls yet, and she's still struggling to reach the campaign finance threshold as well. So that's where the anxiety comes in, and that's where the polls in past years were just political junkie talk really have consequences for a lot of the life and death of some of these candidates further down.
Yeah, my suggestion would be, I don't know what the DNC has exactly in store, but we are already up to nine.
Yeah.
stick with the two nights, split that field up, maybe even by polling results so that we get the top candidates going against each other. It'll give people an opportunity to vet. If they get 9 or 10 people and they put them all on the stage together, it's going to be more of the same.
Mm-hmm. And so next week, we're going to be looking at a couple of high-profile visits, notably the president, right? He's planning to come to Manchester.
Yes.
And then former Vice President Joe Biden staging a rally not far away during the president's visit.
Yeah, and what's interesting, too, was this is once again not Trump controlling the narrative, but dictating the narrative. He plans the trip on Thursday, his rally. Then all of a sudden, Bill Weld, the Republican challenger, is coming in on Saturday for Old Home Day in Belmont and Hudson. Oh, on Monday, Bernie Sanders coming back to New Hampshire for a 2-day trip up in the North Country. Oh, Elizabeth Warren on Wednesday, on the eve of the rally, coming back here for a house party in Wolfboro in a town hall in Franconia. So, and Biden will follow the following week, as will Pete Buttigieg. And right after this trip, we have visits by Cory Booker, Andrew Yang, John Delaney. So all bunched in right after the president's visit. So we're going to be inundated.
Okay. Other news stories we reported this week worth mentioning. Governor Sununu is calling on the National Association that oversees state DMVs to take action following the June crash in Randolph that killed 7 motorcyclists. In a letter submitted Wednesday, Sununu asks the Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators to take up the topic of driver record sharing during its upcoming national conference. New Hampshire DMV officials say they are conducting an in-depth review of its own record-keeping practices. Also, a Queens, New York man who purchased more than 750 liters of liquor in New Hampshire has pled guilty to violating New York's liquor distribution laws. Jun Chen Chen visited 6 different New Hampshire liquor stores on the same day in November 2017. He didn't know it, but tax authorities from New York were trailing him. Chen will pay more than $1,200 in unpaid liquor import taxes. He will forfeit all the liquor, which will be put up for auction. I checked with Todd Bookman. He's going to be covering that, by the way. He's not sure if it's auction for the public or just for people who actually, for wholesalers and whatnot. So stay tuned for reporting from Todd Bookman on that. Also, a new regional group formed to deal with the opioid crisis. held its first public input meeting yesterday in Keene. The Monadnock Rural Communities Opioid Response Project is funded by a $200,000 federal grant. The goal is to develop a regional plan that would identify ways to expand resources and services for those who are struggling with substance use. Also in the news this week, a New Hampshire school district has concluded that a cafeteria company was right to terminate a worker who claimed she was fired for giving a student free lunch. Bonnie Kimball alleges she was fired in March by a food supply vendor from Mascoma Valley Regional High School in Canaan a day after giving free lunch to a student who couldn't pay. Dean, ultimately, what did the investigation find?
Oh, the investigation found that the vendor was actually justified in firing the employee. Originally, Mascoma Valley Regional School District had called for the vendor to rehire the employee. She'd also gotten some, I think, other job offers as a result of all the media coverage of this. The lunch lady getting fired narrative that went viral all over the country. And the argument was that she had actually been giving away multiple free meals to students over several months, and that this was a more systemic issue with her than the initial reporting seemed to show. So this was an independent study that basically said the vendor was justified.
Okay. And finally, for our animal story this week, we're going to turn to Farmington, where a 400-pound bull moose ended up in a pool. Foster's Daily Democrat got a nice photo of the moose, which was not hurt, even though the pool didn't have much water in it. The moose walked out of the pool using the stairs. So, hey, there's not a whole lot to the story except, hey, there's a moose in a pool, and, Foster's Daily Democrat got a good picture of it. It's worth mentioning. Okay. So let's look forward to next week a little bit. Kevin, aside from the president's visit, is there anything you'll be covering, or will you not be covering that?
Yeah, sure. We're certainly focused on Monday, since those three gun bills that's the deadline for them to come up, and we expect the governor to make his decision on that day. So that's going to be a signature story at the beginning of the week.
Anna, what will you be following next week?
Well, August 17th, which is next Saturday, they will start reimbursing legislators again for mileage. So it's not quite next week. It's really the week after that. But we're going to be gearing up again with legislative activity.
Okay. All right. I see. All right. And how about you, Dean?
Right now, everybody is focused on the Iowa State Fair, which just opened, and the obligatory stories of fried Oreos and corn dogs and candidates on the soapbox. Next week, as Kevin alluded to, everything's going to shift here with President Trump's visit on Thursday, and I'm going to be watching all of the activity around it, and I'm looking to see whether he gives a special shout out to Corey Lewandowski, his former campaign manager, who may run for U.S. Senate.
I think I stopped listening as soon as you said fried Oreos and drifted somewhere else.
Bacon-wrapped corn dogs.
Oh, man, stop it. That's it for today. Remember, the conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. I want to thank Kevin Landrigan, State House reporter for the Union Leader, Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Dan Tui is working the cameras today, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. I'm going to take a couple weeks off, but you'll be in the capable hands of NHPR's Casey McDermott and Annie Ropeek in the coming weeks. Thank you very much for listening.
Just wasn't reliable evidence that what took place involved a hate crime.